You may have come across this in the news in the last month, but there was a jailbreak at the Adelaide Zoo recently. You may have heard about it on the news. In fact, this jailbreak made the news all over the world. If you don't believe me, Google it. Something about an orangutan cleverly escaping her captivity clearly captivated the imagination of a lot of people across the planet, me included. Why should this be? This incredible worldwide uptake of a story from little old Adelaide where nothing happens, apart from multiple homicides. Why this incredible uptake worldwide? Was it a slow news day all over the world? Is it just more evidence of the fact that news has devolved into mere amusement and that monkeys are, well, funny? Or is it so unusual anywhere that it's newsworthy everywhere? Or does it play to fear? You know, wild animals busting loose. What next? Lions roaming the streets? Is anyone safe? We interrupt this program to bring you the following news bulletin. A gang of enraged gibbons have managed to tunnel out of the zoo today and were seen heading in the direction of the fruit market. Citizens are advised to remain indoors and hide fruit from plain sight. But I trivialize. The ape escape itself is a whole lot less compelling to me than the global fascination with it. Why? For one thing, and I think one reason is it's just a great story, and it has the great structure of a great story, how and why she escaped, and what she did when she got out. A little background first. Use your imagination. Her name is Karta. She's 27, from Indonesia, about 5'2". 62 kilos, reddish hair, and eyes that seem to look straight into your soul. And I think I love her, despite the fact that she has the intelligence of a 5-year-old human, or maybe because of that fact. But it's okay, Karta loves another. Her partner of many years, Pusung, had died recently, and she's been evidently grieving. And as pain, want, or necessity are the mothers and stepmothers of invention, Karta managed to channel and sublimate all of her grief to achieve, before the aghast onlookers and the aghast zoologists, a kind of mini-evolution, one of those evolutionary leaps that are said to produce sudden mutations in an organism. This leap, it seemed to me, encapsulated all of the major psychological stages of human history. Stage one, evolution stage one, Karta the toolmaker. Karta had already worked out that if you touch the electrified fence, it hurt. Now this is where my ape ancestors' evolution would have stopped. It would have been zzzt ow, zzzt ow, zzzt ow. I'd still be there. But if you touch it holding a stick, it doesn't hurt. Stick not like hand. Stick is magic. This particular stick? No, all sticks. Our sticks are our friends. And thus Karta worked out how to use a tool, a stick, to short-circuit the electric fence. Fence no longer a barrier. Fence now just a climbing frame. Toolmaking, once thought to be exclusive to humans, is, not just in Karta's case, firmly within the tactical repertory of orangutans. Evolution stage two, Karta the Renaissance ape. Shorting out the fence with a tool is one thing, but getting outside the fence and realizing that the fence itself is within a sunken enclosure with a high wall must have been a real blow. But no, she has planned for this. Near the enclosure wall, which was in itself impossible to scale, was a big pile of branches garnered over preceding days without anyone taking any notice. Some of these branches had to be bartered for from the other orangutans. No one noticed her careful plan, which revealed a capacity for imagining a future and for abstract thinking and for social negotiation. The question seemed to be driving her, what would it be like if I got over that wall? And now she compiles enough branches outside the fence to climb up and atop the enclosure wall, which she does. Karta looks out over the zoo, the neighboring parklands, and off into the distance to the city, strange and wonderful in the fading afternoon light. Evolution stage 3, thoroughly modern Karta. She is now free. She's entirely without enclosures. She's free too from the old gods, the higher beings who used to produce food for her in such a way that she was supposed to think it was hidden. Apparently that keeps them occupied. She'd worked that out a long time ago too. Humor them. I have more in me than they think. She is free from these greater beings and from the familiar landscape of her entire world. Now what? She spent half an hour up there just considering her options. Would Pusung be out there somewhere in the vast unknown? How will I find him? Will there be others out there who will help me? What will out there be like? Will it hurt? And so, with a thoroughly modern freedom, Karta has a thoroughly existential problem. Being free, what am I to do? Evolution stage 4, a postmodern Karta. Orangutans, as you may know, are a critically endangered species and plummeting toward extinction. There are 1,000 or so left in rehabilitation centers in Sumatra and Borneo. Their habitats are vanishing as the more numerous planet mates, us, consume ever more of the resources that comprise their habitat. And if no forest survives, where will they be released to when they've been rehabilitated? Well, there are zoos, of course. And let us be clear, a zoo is a kind of a prison. No matter how well-fed you are, no matter how well-appointed the surroundings, no matter what array of culturally suitable diversions are stage-managed for you, you're still in an enclosure. Think about it for yourself. Think if you were told you were imprisoned in a hotel, a good 5-star hotel with a pool and a spa and room service and laundry service, and the only caveat is you can't leave. The French philosopher Foucault writes that actual physical domination of people is no longer required in a postmodern world, but can be achieved through isolation and the constant possibility of observation. The zoo cage, in Karta's case, is like a small theater. The organism is perfectly individualized and constantly visible, much like, well, like us in the postmodern world, perfectly individualized inside our private dwellings and always observable through literal observation, through, by the way, the cameras that are springing up constantly in public spaces, right through to the electronic monitoring of workers, through data monitoring of marketing companies that track your purchases online, to credit agencies that do likewise, ATMs, insurance companies, telecoms, all of whom know your every electronic move. Not to mention the government. To be alive today is to live in a society being constructed where all our behavior is regulated through the fear of theoretical observation by powerful entities. If you don't believe me, go to your web browser and turn off the cookie settings. Cookies are little marketing tracking devices that record where you visit. And just see how many websites you can get to. Not very many. We don't need to be microchipped in the 21st century. We can be found anytime by anybody who wants to. So, having killed the all-seeing, all-judging God, we have remade a social order in His controlling image. We are seen, but never see our controllers. We are the object of information. We are never the subject in communication. Karta's prison, like ours, has been internalized. Welcome to postmodernity. So back to Karta, now with limitless possibilities of freedom before her and years of institutionalization having been internalized inside of her, what did Karta do? You're not going to like it. After a half an hour atop the enclosure wall, weighing all this up, it seems, she loped back into the only home she'd ever known, where food was available, she knew, and where her kind lived. So there was no longer a need for the fences that she had conquered or the walls that she had scaled. She had internalized the mechanisms of control so completely, she had now become her own keeper. So here, I think, is the second key reason why this story resonated so deeply with so many people across the world. In her aspirations and in her plight, we see a clear image of ourselves stripped down to essential needs. Not only did it have the arc of a good story, but it also reminds us of ways in which we understand what it is to be human today. But there's another reason, I think, why the story resonated so deeply. The end of that story, where she goes back into the enclosure freely. Many people found disappointing, this is judging from the blogs that were generated and discussions generated online about this news story. Part of the worldwide fascination, I think, is the disturbance produced by the lack of a Hollywood happy ending. That Carta's bid for freedom was achieved, but not resolved somehow. Well, Rob, so what? Orangutans, after all, aren't really like humans, are they? Well, consider the following. In the last year, Spain's parliament, composed of thoughtful, sober, professional people, have recently voiced support for the rights of great apes to life and freedom. Oh, just wacky Europeans, I'm sure. Now, not wacky Europeans. This declaration in the Spanish Parliament, which is now being considered by the European Union, was devised by scientists and philosophers who said, "Our closest genetic relatives deserve rights hitherto limited only to humans." So how much are they like us? How much are the great apes like us? How close is close? Well, 98%. 98% similarity in terms of DNA. Now that's closer than, say, any two major breeds of dogs. But that genetic similarity of only 2% difference is not the only argument. The ethicist, the Australian ethicist, Peter Singer, and others have tried to express just what it is that indicates personhood. It turns out that great apes have all these criteria. I'll briefly list them. 1, rationality and self-awareness. Well, tool making and using, previously considered unique to humans, indicates the comprehension of cause and effect and complex problem solving. It also shows self-reflection, the ability to think about an experience without prompting from external stimuli. So, one personhood tick for Carta. 2, self-control. Carta's project was certainly purposeful and required persistent application of a planned set of actions. These were not derailed by her other interests of food and sleep. 2 personhood ticks for the orangutan. 3 for personhood, a sense of the future. Well, the notion of escape and there being an out there at all, 3 personhood ticks for the orangutan. 4, a sense of the past. Well, Carta was grieving, so 4 personhood ticks. 5, the capacity to relate to others. The social networking Carta had to engage in to negotiate the collection of sticks, 5 ticks for personhood. 6, concern for others. This was not evident in Carta's case, but it's widely documented in other research on the great apes. There is a story that you may have heard in the California San Diego Zoo of a silverbacked gorilla called Binti, who, when a small toddler fell into the enclosure, a human toddler fell into the enclosure, Binti, with her own baby on her back, went over to the toddler, gently picked it up, rocked and caressed it until the humans could come and human zookeepers could come and collect it. So that's 6, concern for others. 7, for personhood, curiosity. What's behind the wall? That's another tick for Carta. And finally, communication. Not evident in Carta's case, but famous studies that I remember taking when I was an undergraduate of Washoe the chimp and many others have been taught sign language to converse with humans, with each other, and with themselves. They talk to themselves. They make jokes in sign language, puns in sign language, and laugh at them. In fact, considering that list, I know some humans that fail to meet many of these criteria. So again, what's human? What's ape-like? The divide between the two is not so clear anymore. And the differences seem not to be differences in kind, but differences of degree. Research shows all great apes, like human persons, do have these capacities. And Carta, in this case I've been talking about today, has exhibited 6 of 8 of these in this one event, passing in a short space from toolmaker to postmodern object, through the stages of enlightenment, optimism, and the modern confrontation with existential freedom, all of human history, and deciding at the end, as we all more or less do, to accept our comfortable cell and count out our days. But how she escaped and what it means is not nearly so affecting as why she did it. Zoo officials were forthright in saying that she was depressed and grieving at the loss of her longtime mate, Pusung. That all great apes grieve. And if they grieve, then something not unlike love must have been happening, for there can be no sense of separation if there was not once a union. But can we know that this is going on in an ape's head? Zoos provide the best environment possible, but it can't be known if a zoo makes apes happy. Indeed, as humans, we really don't understand our own happiness that well, how to make ourselves happy. And grief in humans is also poorly understood. I mean, after all, people do strange things out of grief, too. So again, interpreting Carta's jailbreak and her voluntary reincarceration may just come down to our preferred reading. One, apes are not like us, therefore this is just the story of a troublesome subhuman who's clever enough to escape, but fundamentally lazy. The meal ticket wins out over the will to freedom, and the dumb animal returns to where the food is. Or two, apes are like us, and so suffering led to a bid for freedom, that freedom to knowledge, and that knowledge to acceptance of life as it's known, rather than chancing the unknown. The research I've referred to tends to suggest that the second reading may be the truer. It's certainly the richer reading. And even if you dispute the appropriateness of bestowing human rights upon great apes, you'd have to agree that in not doing so, you'd be taking away more from them than you'd be giving them. For Carta's case shows that they are rather like us, even at our most morally timid. Well, what if we were to grant great apes a dignity or personhood equal to our own? Given that the differences are a matter of degree rather than a matter of kind. It baffles me that some people shake their heads at embryonic stem cell research, which is, after all, just a clump of cells. But when we're talking about the great apes, like the orangutan, we're talking here about a being with the intelligence of a 5-year-old human. And we typically regard this being as less than human. Matter of degree. Wouldn't we have to radically reevaluate what it is that makes us human or special? Maybe, just maybe, we're not that special after all. That like us, the apes are born and grow up and die in a fix. And like us, they also seem to know it. And if we allow the dignity of human rights to great apes, why stop? Why not grant dignity and freedom to all sentient beings? Not eat them, not cage them, not experiment on them, not wear their skin and fur. That is, really begin to live as though we all share this planet and its resources, and that there is Therefore, after all, more that unites us than divides us. Would this not also grant a greater dignity to ourselves as well? Well, those ideas are a kind of parallel reality that social movement groups like PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and my favorite, GRASP, the Great Ape Standing and Personhood Project, GRASP, opposing thumbs, get it? That's the sort of parallel reality that those sorts of social movement groups envision, a world of truly open hearts, where we venerate the miracle of all sentient beings, not just our own species. They suggest that the notion of species is in itself specious. Notions of species are, after all, artificial categories imposed by human thinking, deciding where to draw a dividing line, fairly arbitrarily. Perhaps we'd be a little less neurotically self-centered, a little less in love with the notion of us alone occupying the tip of creation, the tip of an imagined Darwinian tree. This human-centered assumption underlies most traditional fundamentalist religion. God made humans special. The theory of evolution messily blurs the divide between us and our planet mates and makes many, many, many shaved apes like us nervous. Yes, I believe God made me in one day. Yep, looks like he rushed it. For myself, speaking personally, I would rather be descended from a wily ape than from a bigoted fundamentalist nincompoop any day. We already sense when we go to the zoo in our bones that our connections with the great apes, which I think is why for a while the whole world wanted to know about this story. We wanted her to be free, having richly earned it, and because we feel we can't really be. And this is why we may, in our head, supply the happy Hollywood ending. In my imagination and in others, I see a lone hominid sitting atop a prison wall, scaled triumphantly as part of a self-willed evolution into personhood, gazing off into the unknown, at the strange city, at the hills which ring the Garna Plains, but instead of slinking back off to rejoin the safe and the known, I see her take a deep breath, leap from the wall, and tear off through the park, bounding away, skirting the shrieking hominids holding ice cream and chips up to their gaping frozen mouths, heading for the thickets, clambering nimbly up the trees and out of the zoo grounds, off. Off toward the lushly vegetated hills as the sun begins to set, running, running to find Pusung, and if not Pusung, to just keep going. And because it's my fantasy, I'm there, of course, and I'm cheering her on with my voice catching in my throat as I cry, "Run, Carter, run, and don't look back!" But that's not how it played out, of course. And in her return, we may see an image of our own self-maintained, well-appointed prisons. Like most of us, I don't know perfectly how to make myself happy, but I know I would be depressed to think that we just can't handle freedom. Maybe we're just not ready yet, like her. But maybe we're set to evolve too. Who says it's over? Maybe when we realize that we've internalized the mechanisms of our own control, have willfully disempowered ourselves, we might then begin looking around for the tools to short-circuit our wires with. And then, who knows what we could become? The story of Carta has an epilogue. Carta has a new male friend who is kind and loving towards her. And the rumor is she's expecting. And if there is a heaven, I feel sure that Pusung would be smiling at this. He would smile to know that grief ends, that love returns, and the genes are passed on as the great planet rolls. And if the child of this union thrives armed with Carta's genes, who knows what it might become? Amen. It's time in our order of service to throw open for discussion. And as we have a few minutes, it's perfectly acceptable. And I'll just referee, play traffic cop, anything that discussion kicked up for you, made you think about, made you question. So, ball's in your court now.
Intelligence, IQ, is an interesting notion. I've had a lot to do with it over the years, and I don't really find it very useful concept. I think we're probably doing Carter a disservice by measuring her against the test that we've devised. Carter was the test of intelligence, it would probably be
which we'd fail spectacularly.
The perception of distance and judgment and weight and whether a branch can contain that, I think, would be far superior to mine.
Agreed. Mine too.
I would question whether, in fact, she is your average 5-year-old child.
That's, of course, an estimate that it's one of those factoids that you come across, that the average orangutan is more or less the intellectual equivalent of a 5-year-old human.
I'd be surprised because the 5-year-old can be pretty smart.
Yeah.
I don't think it's insulting, Carter, to say that. I think there are some pretty clever 5-year-olds.
Well, I know one who was. She's up there at the moment. Yes. And of course, the Heisenberg principle, as John points out, really applies here, that a thing is changed by our observing it, because we're bringing all of our complete ensemble of awareness to understanding this thing. But our point of view on it is not the whole story. It probably has a point of view about us, too.
I think there's an interesting... So the experiments that were done with, I think it was squirrels, not temperature, probably squirrels or chipmunks, in which machines were put out into the bush, basically requiring a certain amount of mouse to figure out how to get out the nuts. When certain figured it out, they would teach others who would then be able to work the answer. There was an interesting thought is that you could hypothetically put in place, because the thing is that our species evolved because there was evolutionary pressure for us to evolve in the way that we did. And it'd be interesting to see if there would be any way of, in a sense, spurring on the next sentence, the next species that would be able to develop technology and all the rest of things much like we can. Just by affecting the kind of evolution pressures out there.
You'll note that I avoided any reference to Planet of the Apes in this. I could have gone there, didn't. But yeah, I mean, I think evolution's a fascinating concept because the notion that we're the final chapter is crazy. if it's happening, it's still happening.
Well, in fact, there was an interesting throughout, and it talked about the various stages of evolution, so things like the evolution of replicating molecules, the genetic code, sex, and all the way up there. And that we, one of the particular key ones that we seem to have is something like grammar. What you're saying, that may well be evolved prior to our species, very late to demonstrate some ability to recognize that.
Certainly, Washoe, the chimp, and those studies on chimpanzees learning sign language and then using the sign language to make puns within sign language. They've also been taught in Japanese studies to communicate with a series of sound sort of phoneme units It's a very limited repertoire, but if you could, basically to use any sort of symbol, be it a sign, a word, a sound, or a, you know, a squiggle on a piece of paper, is to be able to think abstractly. That is to say, removed from reality, removed from physical stimuli. And if you can think abstractly, and you have the capability of self-reflection, how are you different from us exactly, except in the degree of its development?
That's right.
You know,
it's a case of expansionism rather than mm-hmm. a specific point. But interesting, just on that sort of same thing, is that so one of the points that's brought up is that, in fact, we very much might not be the final stage. In fact, if you have a look at the way that it's all been done, it all has to do with information. Mm. One of the key developments of evolution that we've faced is the fact that we have something like GRAM, which allows amazing repertoire of words and of concepts to communicate with each other in an incredibly sophisticated way. But that's now taking a step back to other forms of information, things like digital technology. It's very much the thought that the thing that could place us in terms of the top of the evolutionary chain might not even be life.
Yeah.
More to the point, might not be biological life. Mm.
Now, you wouldn't be the first person to suggest that if what we deem to be intelligence has to do with the complexity of information and the ability to manipulate it in ever more complex ways, then certainly, you know, my handheld phone is smarter than I am. As long as it doesn't become conscious, I'm very happy of it. But at the same time, you'd have to have one. You'd have to imagine a computer that would know when it's inappropriate to turn itself on. That's reason. Reason, as Aristotle understood it, is that facility of mind that knows when not to use itself.
I do suspect, though, that variable might be a question of degree rather than time.
I think the point of that is it's all a question of degree, and that if you take that as read, then the interrelatedness, the interconnectedness of living things becomes much more full and miraculous, and that our insistence on chopping it up into kind of categories of sentience it is our own way of just organizing it so that we can kind of teach it, but bears no relationship to what's actually happening. Quite. We need neat parcels. We need neat parcels, chunks.
It seems to me the wisdom of the indigenous races throughout the world can really teach us a lot about the way the human mind actually develops. I'm thinking about our own indigenous folk and the way they think. I have a little to do with them. I think I understand them a little. And it is such an arrogance on our part to believe that we can bring them into our way of thinking in short scales of time.
Mm.
It's a very slow process, but it is also miraculous. And it's one of the wonders of the whole creation and of the human mind, that it can be so, that they can be so different from us, that it does need humility on our part to try better to understand where they actually come from.
Well said. Very well said.
Perhaps it strikes me that humanity does understand algorithms. Perhaps that's a symptom of our own perception of our inadequacy in terms of understanding that we resort to algorithms to devise ways of understanding the world. Perhaps getting back to Carter, she has no need for algorithms, but perhaps there are imaginings and understandings and perceptions beyond our own imagining, beyond our thoughts.
Well, we know that the perceptual systems of other animals perceive things that we're blind to. Bees see magnetic fields and ultraviolet, and you know, it's there's more going on than we have a window to. And that's, yeah. I think it's wonderful. And I also think that the worldwide uptake of the story, which should have just been a local, you know, human interest story, the worldwide uptake of it means that there are echoes of something profound going on with that. And it's not just a slow news day, you know. Those were rhetorical questions. Sorry if I missed that. Anyone else want to chime?